I'd like to introduce Ty Taylor, who is a member of our steering committee and who has played an active role in the assessment of the SBIR program. We have asked him to return. He brings exceptional experience with early stage funding. He's also has broad experience as a senior executive in NASA, and we are very pleased to have Ty with us this afternoon.
Hi there, thanks for hanging in here with us. Everybody still awake? Ready to go? All right, excellent. Listen, I'm just going to take a few moments, take advantage of the fact that I'm a moderator and try and provide a couple, a little platform for thoughts as it relates to what I think our panelists will say. But the first thing I wanted to do, though, was thank our illustrious chair, Jack Gansler, and also Chuck, for your collective leadership. A lot of times, you know, we get on the issue of minorities and women and all of that, and obviously we know that this is part and parcel of the legislative mandate to foster the participation of minorities and women in the program. And quite frankly, we have had some very robust debates, and but more importantly, we have not shied away, the committee overall, in talking about this as well as any other issue, be it, you know, VC funding, early stage VC funding in the NIH in particular, SBIR program. So I applaud you for that, and I certainly look forward to continued robust debate in that arena. In preparation for this, I did a little research, and these are not my charts. These are actually charts from the Minority Business Development Agency. I mean, some of you may know that they are about roughly a $30 million enterprise founded probably about 20 years ago by executive order within the Department of Commerce. And their primary function is to really to help to facilitate the growth of minority business entrepreneurs. And for them, they include the women in that category as well. They probably within the last year or so have contributed to about completion of roughly $2 billion in transactions in the forms of loans, in the forms of equity investments, in the form of helping MBEs obtain both federal and commercial contracts. But most recently, they just actually presented a full report to Capitol Hill, in particular to the Commerce, Science, and Justice Committee, on their findings. This was done in March. And what I've done is just pulled out very quickly a couple of their key slides just to stimulate our thinking. And, very quickly, disparities exist. You probably know that, but they've documented it. We'll talk about perhaps why they exist. Disparities in capital grow over time. So if you're starting out with a weak platform, it doesn't sometimes necessarily get any better over time. Good news, MBEs are, in fact, good investments. If you find the right ones that work with you with the right materials and the right backing, they can be as successful as anyone else. Interestingly enough, and there's something called SMOBE data, and it's that was a study done by Tuck University, the Tuck Business School, a couple years ago. But essentially, it's demonstrating that minority growth in a minority sector, and by the way, this data cuts across all sectors. It's not just limited to high tech. It's actually, generally speaking, growing at a faster rate than the majority firms. And then lastly, and very important, job creation is extremely strong. Okay, so that being said, take a look at this. Financial constraints, lower asset levels, lending discrimination, other discrimination issues, access to networks, human capital, education doesn't make a difference. Some of us are successful because, you know, it's kind of in our blood. We've got that DNA. Our families have some experience there. And one of the interesting things that I find is that, and I'll show it this very last chart, is that there are some new trends emerging within the MBE community that are demonstrating that the growth of those jobs are every bit as significant as the majority firms. Here, very quickly, you look at loan and equity investments, both under 500,000 and above 500,000, you can see the disparities. Percent of firms receiving equity investments, again, you can see the changes, or the differences, I should say. Now look at the average loan size and the value of those equity investments. And we all know that when you're asking for money, it doesn't take a lot more work to ask for $100,000 than it does for $1 million. Right? So, but there are these changes. And there, I'm sure, some valid reasons for that. But look at this. Now, I find this one very interesting. young MBEs, young minority entrepreneurs, are now creating jobs at similar rates compared to young non-minority firms. Now, my immediate reaction to this would be, is it driven because of better education? Is it driven because they're now, they've kind of burst through the bubble? Is it driven because it's just better access in general? I don't know. But if you look at the number of jobs, they're every bit as competitive. Every bit as competitive. And as the, some of the previous panelists talked about, the importance of job creation and sustainability are so important. We are, you know, the benefit, we all know the strength of our nation is, in fact, in its diversity, both in terms of people and its industrial base. We can't afford to not be more of an inclusive society from an R&D perspective. And the great thing about SBIR is, and we all know, it's a pretty level playing field within the R&D community. It really is. You and I could form a company tomorrow, and we've probably got a pretty good shot. If we know how to write to that topic, you and I could do something. And we have those, you know, that's real. We have those success stories. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to our panelists. We were very fortunate here to have Terrence Hicks, who was the VP for the investment group at Ben Franklin Technology Partners, but also he is the founder of the Minority Angel Investor Network. He'll talk to you next. And then we've got with us Cindy. I'm sorry. I apologize. Cindy Padnos, who has done some very interesting work. She is, in fact, the founding manager and director of Illuminate Ventures, which has made a tremendous amount of investments in very talented, growing firms, but in particular, those that are very inclusive of women. And I think you'll be very interested to see some of the results of those firms that she's invested in. So with that, let me turn the podium over to Terrence, and thank you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for hanging in there. It's been a long but very, very productive day. This is the advance. I'm delighted to be here today to talk about something that we in Philadelphia are extremely passionate about, and that is funding early stage technology companies. Also, we've made some demonstrable progress in helping to remove some of the barriers and enhance some of the access to capital to minority owned and led primarily technology companies. So I'd like to walk you through some of that experience that we've had in Philadelphia. By way of introduction, John, one of our former speakers, very eloquently talked about the Ben Franklin Technology Partnership Program, so I'm not going to talk in any great length about it, except to say that there are four Ben Franklins across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The one that I represent is in southeastern Pennsylvania, Ben Franklin of southeastern Pennsylvania. As John pointed out, it's a 27-year-old TBED, or Technology-Based Economic Development Organization. Our mission basically is to stimulate economic growth through technology and innovation. We want to create technology entrepreneurs and jobs and products in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we do that through providing a host of services, but we're probably best known by providing direct investments, providing dollars in companies. In southeastern Pennsylvania, we provide dollars anywhere from $50,000 up to $750,000 in the form of convertible debt or straight equity. I have a portfolio of 120 companies that I'm responsible for, one of the largest seed portfolios in the country. Last year, we were honored by being listed as one of the top 100 venture capital firms for early stage companies based on the volume of activity in 2008. Today's portfolio is approximately 13% minority, which I'm also quite proud to say as well. That's 15 companies out of the 120. Also proud to say that four of those companies have SBIRs. Another fact. Now, one might say, well, 13%, that's not a huge number. But if I were to wind back the clock 5 years ago or 10 years ago when I took responsibility for this portfolio, we had a startlingly low number of minority companies in the portfolio, and minority was rather broadly defined. And at the time, when I kind of took a look at the portfolio and said, well, what can we do to generate more minority companies in the portfolio, it became very clear that the capital gap indeed really did exist. this capital gap was real. And it's essentially an inability to access capital for company growth. Around the same time, the folks at the Milken Institute basically did a study that kind of corroborated that by saying that even after accounting for factors such as education, experience, industry, and location, minority firms receive less capital, and if they receive it, if they're fortunate enough to receive it, they receive it on less advantageous terms. Sounds like a minority capital gap to me. This is the kind of the valley of death, the capital gap. There have been speakers earlier that have talked very eloquently about this, so I'm not going to say a whole lot about it, except to point out that the players that provide capital along the continuum are the regular players, you know them, the founders, the friends, the family, the universities, the angel groups, the teabag organizations like ourselves. SBIR plays a critical role, the seed funds and venture funds. The interesting thing that's happened over time, though, is that Valley of Death has moved over to the right. There's been a dramatic shift of that Valley of Death over to the right. Most of the venture funds today are very large funds of over $100 million. They can't productively put $750,000 or $1 million to work. They've got to put it out in $5 million, $6 million chunks. So that's left a real funding gap for those companies in my portfolio. After I funded them for $500,000 or $750,000, where do they get that Series A investment for $1 million, $1.5 million? That's a critical gap that we find. Now, obviously, there's always the friends and family, kind of the bootstrapping gap at the other end, but a true valley of death. So we have the capital continuum, and there are the regular players. Now, let me show you something that looks a little different, if I can get this to work. Little different than the previous slide. These are the same arrows, okay, as I had on the previous slide, but it looks like the arrows on SlimFast. Some of these arrows are a little smaller than the ones that were on the previous slide. So if you look at the friends and family piece of that arrow, substantially less than all other markets. Robin Farley did a study back in 2006 out of the University of North Carolina. Minority firms tend to start businesses with lower levels of personal wealth and face barriers when tapping traditional sources. So you can see where the arrows are a little anemic along the angel route. Now, interestingly enough, I was told by the National Association of Investment Companies a number of years ago, for those of you who don't know, this is a trade association for private equity funds that invest primarily in the emerging domestic market, or minority companies, represents $10 billion under management. They told me, Terry, if you can fund the companies to the point at which a venture investor would invest, we would invest. But we have this significant valley of death. We don't have angel investors that will invest. We don't have other forms of investment that will get them to the venture. If you could put something in place that would fund them up to the venture point, then we indeed would invest. This slide also points out kind of the dearth of angel investment capital as it relates to minorities. Minorities, as representative in angel investing groups, represent 3.5% of its members. Small percentage of minority deals present to angel groups, only 6.2% of the deals. And of those deals that present, only 14.2% of those deals actually secure investments from those groups. A few other factoids. Most angel groups are comprised of white males, no surprise, with investments awarded to firms owned by white males, no surprise. Currently, at least 6 all-women angel groups exist, with interest expressed in about 10 others, according to the Kauffman Foundation. A couple that we're familiar with is Phenomenal Angels in Wisconsin and Golden Seeds, which just recently opened up a branch in Philadelphia. But up until today, there is only one organized angel group that invests primarily, in high-growth minority companies, and that's our group out of Philadelphia, the Minority Angel Investor Network. Okay, so back in 2004, it was my charge basically to come up with a strategy for increasing the percentage of minority companies in the Ben Franklin portfolio. Now, why did I come up with forming an angel group? Well, primarily because we work very closely with angel investors. 50% of the deals that I do out of Ben Franklin, I do side by side with angel investors. So we were very familiar with angels anyway. So what we did, I pulled together a few buddies, and we went through our Rolodexes, and we said, let's pull together a focus group and see if there might be some interest in forming a minority-focused angel group. And basically, that's what we did. In February 2004, we pulled together a focus group, and the consensus was to form an angel group with the focus of investing in minority-owned and led companies. We did a press launch and a reception in 2004 with the endorsement of the National Association of Investment Companies. We recruited 10 members over the summer of 2004, and we held our first meeting in November 2004 and have met every month since then. Now, thanks to the Kauffman Foundation, they provided some early support with the $75,000 planning grant, as well as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania provided some early support as well. What do we look like today? Over the years, we've made 20 investments totaling a little over $2 million. All technologies, all of our members prefer or have an appetite for technology. We're invested in software, drugs, vaccine development, telemetry. We're also invested in two early stage venture funds. Our investments range anywhere from $25,000 up to $400,000. We have 20 members, 16 men, 4 women. You see the racial profile, so we're very diverse. The professional profile, also very diverse. And we have a robust deal flow. If folks think that there aren't minority technology companies out there, I'm here to tell you they're out there. They're hitting our website daily. Okay, thought I'd give you a snapshot of what we're experiencing in Philadelphia, not only in the Ben Franklin portfolio, but in the Minority Investor, Angel Investor Network portfolio. Again, we have 120 companies in the Ben Franklin portfolio. 17% of those companies have SBIR, 16 of the 105 that are non-minority have SBIR, and of the minority portion of the Ben Franklin portfolio, 4 of 15 companies have SBIR for a total of 17% of the overall Ben Franklin portfolio. In the smaller Minority Angel Investor Network, we have 1 of 6, so the statistics aren't that material, but that as well is 17%. And it just happens that our SBIR experience in Philadelphia with Ben Franklin as well as our network is primarily in life sciences. The companies that are being awarded are life science companies. So while there's insufficient data points here to support the notion of a significant disparity between access to and familiarity with SBIR, but as BDA points out, there is a disparity. We can't hide our heads in the sand. There is really a disparity. So notwithstanding the statistics that are borne out by my portfolio in Philadelphia, a disparity does exist. And one might ask, well, so what? I mean, why should a disparity matter? Well, primarily because minority companies and women-owned companies matter these days. Here are a couple factoids here, some of which you've heard before. There's a renewed investor interest driven in part by the recognition that changing U.S. demographics. There's a change in U.S. demographics. There's a significant increase in minority purchasing power and business development by minority-owned firms. Women-owned firms, particularly among ethnic women, increased at a rate of 5 times greater than all firms. Tyrone pointed this out as well. This is a study done by Tim Bates and William Bradford with regard to minorities and venture capital. It is profitable to invest in minority-owned and led companies. So there is a reason for us to care about this disparity and bridging this and solving this access to capital problem. So I just leave you with this question: what can be done to promote and to secure more early stage capital for high growth minority owned or led companies, including SBIR? And we've heard a number of interesting concepts today, anything from angel pools to tax credits. And it's far beyond the scope of these few minutes that I have to speak to go into any of those. But I would encourage us to continue a dialogue in talking about these issues, because this gap is real. And until we bridge it in some way, we won't realize the true value of these entrepreneurs out there that to date have been prevented free access. Thank you.
I'm Cindy Patnis. I'm the founding managing director of Illuminate Ventures. As Ty mentioned, our focus is on early stage high-tech venture capital investing. However, we have a very focused strategy of being much more inclusive of women-founded and women co-founded businesses in our deal flow strategy. That does not mean that we use a different investment criteria. It is completely gender neutral when we evaluate businesses. But we are very proactive in expanding the access to women entrepreneurs, and we do that for good reason. It really is all about performance, and that's part of what I'm going to share with you today. I have been a founder and CEO myself. I have led a venture-backed company to a successful M&A. I have been part of a team that took a company, a high-tech company, public, and I've now been on the investing side for about 8 years. Illuminate Ventures was just founded last year. We've done four proof of concept investments out of the fund. Three of those happen to have women co-founders. Two have women CEOs, which, by the way, is an order of magnitude above the industry average. It was not done intentionally. It happened entirely because of great quality deal flow. So why focus on women? What's the impetus today, and why is it important for us to address the issue of a lack of capital access in that category? It's fundamental. It is literally, as I think Terry just mentioned, the fastest growing category of entrepreneurship in the United States. Women-led companies are growing at 5 times the pace of all companies on average. They represent today better than 40%, somewhere between 40 and 50% of all privately held companies in the United States. And indeed, they are achieving the kind of performance that we can all recognize. People like Diane Greene, who founded VMware, had the single largest IPO of 2007. She built a company called VMware, as I said. That company created an entire industry in information technology, and it is virtualization, data virtualization, if you're familiar with that. And yet, there are few Diane Greens out there, and that's part of what we're trying to address that issue. Women, of course, have vast spending power. I don't think there's anyone, male or female, in this audience that would doubt that. Women today control 75% of all discretionary spending in the United States, and it's expected to reach that number worldwide within the next couple of years. They also, however, continue to receive small amounts of capital. They are underfunded at the very earliest stages, very similar to what Terry was indicating regarding minority-led firms. And that impact, while not as significant in those early stages, if you're in a high-growth industry, which is the focus of our business, all within information technology, that has dramatic impact over time. So what I'm going to share with you is the result, actually, of a white paper that we published in February. The reason for producing this white paper, by the way, was entirely because we wanted to know ourselves whether or not there was a real market opportunity. Do we build a firm about being inclusive if there aren't enough of them out there, if they underperform once they receive capital, if they don't have the right educations or work experience, et cetera? The answer to that, frankly, would have been no. The data I found to be quite compelling, and it was a big part of the motivation. I will tell you, I was fairly disappointed, or maybe frustrated would be a better way to put it, when I went out to collect this information, because I thought all I had to do was go to Catalyst or the Center for Women's Business Research or Astia or Springboard or the National Center for Women in Information Technology. I could keep going. It's a really long list. But the reality was no one had ever consolidated this data. The research that was out there previously that had been funded by Kauffman Foundation was 5 to 7 years old. And really, I didn't feel comfortable that it was relevant for what we wanted, the decisions we were making. What we found is a stark chasm, if you will, a really significant gap between the level of capability, the level of readiness, if you will, and what I would call venture readiness of women entrepreneurs and the actual funding that's there. And that's what I'm going to share with you in this presentation, both sides of the equation. What is the opportunity and what is the funding situation, and a little bit about what I think we can do about it. So the myths that are out there, and these were all discussed, by the way, years ago in the Diana Project, so there's not a lot new here. The myths still remain. Women aren't educated in the right categories. They don't have the right work experience. And by the way, I am a liberal arts undergrad with an MBA out of one of the most technical programs in the country, out of Carnegie Mellon, and have been a founder and CEO, and many of the women founder CEOs I know do not have engineering degrees. They have a great technical founder who works with them, as I did, but they do not necessarily have those engineering degrees themselves. In fact, I was discouraged from doing it in my undergrad years. The themes, of course, they're not interested in entrepreneurship, et cetera. We'll address some of those. So where are we today in terms of education? Today, girls are literally on par for the first time with boys in terms of their level of understanding and capability in math and science. This is the first time ever. So part of what I want to share with you is that discrepancy that existed perhaps 30 years ago or 20 years ago or even 10 years ago may have been legitimate, but it's not today. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the reasons it's not. There are more women enrolling in higher education, and by the way, today over 50% of all undergraduate degrees and 50% of all master's degrees and close to 50% of all doctorate degrees are granted to women. So it is not a lack of education that's standing in the way any longer. In addition, it's equally important, perhaps more important, to look at where they're getting those degrees. And in particular, if you're forming a high-tech business, there are two areas that are the most relevant, engineering and MBA programs. In other words, business savvy and the ability to contribute to intellectual property. Those are the things we care about as an investor. Those are the kinds of backgrounds I'm looking for in the entrepreneurs that I fund. And what you'll see here is an enormous growth. Now, some people in the room will raise their hands and say, but I thought the numbers were declining. And they're right. In the very recent years, in the last 3 or 4 years, the percentage of women entering into some of these programs has actually started to tail off. And that's pretty startling, certainly disappointing and concerning. But in a moment, as I talk about what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur, you'll understand that what we really care about is who was getting their education 10 and 20 years ago. Obviously, we care about those that are coming through the pipeline still today, but what's relevant for a venture-backable company, and in particular those founded by women, it turns out that women found their companies literally, on average, 10 years older than men. Men generally are 25 to 35. Women are 35 to 45. And I think we can probably guess what some of the reasons behind that are. One of the really important things here is what's happening in terms of women's contributions to intellectual property. We can thank a woman by the name of Mary Keyes, who in 1809 filed the very first patent ever filed by a woman with only her name on it. It was for some process of weaving thread and silk and straw together to make hats, but it was the first patent. If you see what's happened, if we fast forward to today, in a period of time that is really quite interesting, as we compare the 1980-85 time frame to the 2000 to 2005 time frame, the level of patent activity by women grew 14 times growth. At the same time, the overall activity was growing at 5 times growth. In other words, 3 times the average. What's extraordinary is the growth within the area that I care most about, which was within computer software, with the growth of women's patenting, of course, starting from a small base, but the growth is literally 45% difference over that period, so quite extraordinary. So we've talked about education. What about work experience? One of the best indicators of work experience, and those that venture investors look at, is has this person been a part of a successful team previously? And one of the best indicators of that, especially in high tech, is have they been an officer of a publicly traded company, a company that went public effectively. So we did some research And I was able to draw upon research that had been done by a number of other academics that were out there, but we did our own as well. And we identified an enormous change in the percentage of high-tech companies with women officers over the last 30 years. When we look back at 2009, those numbers had gone obviously off the chart, with 17 of those companies having women officers. And by the way, in case anyone is wondering, this little question in your back of your head, no, we did not include a single woman on this list that was a VP of HR. So they had to be operating officers of the company, or we didn't count them, because as far as we were concerned, neither would an investor, and nor should we. If you look at what's going on in terms of whether or not women are entrepreneurial, that's the other myth. Oh, women don't really want to be entrepreneurs. They don't want to start companies. It simply isn't true. At present, women now are applying for angel capital. They represent 16% of those who apply. Interestingly enough, the transition or success rate there is actually comparable, if not slightly better, than those companies that are founded by men that are applying for venture capital. So they're coming in with very well-qualified business opportunities. Their membership in groups that are younger women wanting to start entrepreneurial companies has grown extraordinarily. There's a group in the Bay Area, it's now nationwide, called Women 2.0. It did not exist 3.5 years ago. Today it has over 10,000 members nationwide. All young women entrepreneur wannabes, if you will, all have at minimum an undergraduate degree. Somewhere close to 40% also have a master's degree, and all of them are already working in management positions in high tech. So amazing what the growth is. You can see what the percentage of women-owned businesses is in the U.S. today in the privately held sector, and it has grown extraordinarily over the last 30 years. So all of that is great, but what about performance? And that was really my biggest concern and the piece that I found very little data on that was consolidated in any one place. We went and found some amazing research data that had been done by Babson, by the London Business School, by Kauffman Foundation, by a group in the UK called Liberty House. And those organizations identified that indeed women start companies with on average 30 to 40% less capital than those companies founded by men. They actually make the transition from startup to successful company more frequently. In other words, they fail less frequently than those companies with all male founders. And they, the data that we gathered showed over 200 women in over 125 companies that had achieved what we would call successful venture exits. And that threshold was greater than $50 million disclosed M&A or an IPO. And they had to have been a co-founder or officer of that company at the time of that exit. So the numbers, by the way, are significantly undercounted. This is only the last 10 years. It's only information technology. And it's only disclosed M&As, and we all know most of them are undisclosed. So even a company like Flickr, which had a great exit at $40 million, didn't make this list because it was 40, not $50 million. So the other research we found, we sort of stumbled on in this performance question, was fascinating. It really showed how women-led businesses were performing, but also how any business that had better gender diversity outperformed the norm. And there's been research that's been done over literally 10 years with 15,000 companies at Cornell and University of Columbia and University of Maryland jointly. There's been research done at the University of Michigan, my other alma mater, that demonstrates that those working groups that have better gender diversity have better decision-making capability, independent of whether or not their IQ level was higher or lower. So quite interesting. So if we have all of these things in place, the right education, the right work experience, the right ambitions, right age, they're finally, you know, got those degrees 20 years ago, and the right performance, what is the problem? Why aren't there more women-founded companies out there? And I'll show you what the data is. It may be a little startling to you, but literally today, somewhere in the range of 5 to 7% of venture capital in information technologies goes into a company with even one woman co-founder. If you look at those with women CEOs, it's roughly 3%. And even then, at the peak in 2000, when it was closer to 10% of all the deals, it was only 3% of the capital. So the numbers are really quite small. So how do they fund their companies? They self-finance, as any high-tech startup has to, but they're doing that having earned, on average, 12 to 15% lower salaries for the same positions in the U.S. still today. Bank debt, where they have a level playing field, and that includes SBA funding, is literally twice as likely to be used to fund a woman-led company in high tech as one led by a man. And angel investment is gaining, and that's significant as well. So why do we care about venture dollars? It's pretty clear, because in the venture world, it's not just about money. It's about all of the other things that you get access to. It's about the relationships. It's about having the best recruiters. It's about the credibility that you have with a customer who's willing to take a chance on you and buy your product because Illuminate Ventures or Battery Ventures or Sequoia has put money into your company. It's a whole set of factors. And clearly, when venture-backed companies are growing jobs at three times the rate, it's significant. Why the gap? You probably have heard some of these things already. One of them is pattern recognition. Ask any 99 out of 100 VCs that I know, how do you know a great investment when you see one? And the words that come out of their mouth, it's all about pattern recognition, Cindy. You know one when you see one. Well, when the whole history of investment is investing in one category and not another, it's obvious that it's a lot harder to recognize that opportunity. Lack of visibility is important. Self-selection is important. Women, in fact, choose not to go to all firms that may have all men in them simply for the reason that is the case. And here's a good example of what it looks like on the other side. In venture today, in information technology, this is a look at the prior 2 years, most active firms in venture, those with over $250 million under management and those with less. And you'll see that roughly 5% of venture capital partners are women. It's slightly higher in those with smaller amounts under capital than newer, smaller firms. And those numbers are changing. So what can we do? There's a long list here because there are a lot of things that we can do to change this equation. And it goes from, the mentoring and coaching kind of programs that exist through the nonprofits like ASTIA and Springboard and others, to ensuring that women are even aware of the SBIR financing that's available, because many I know are not. And also increasing the number of women investors. It's been shown that those organizations, those firms that have even one woman partner, are 70% more likely to invest in a woman-led company than those with none. And so there's some very significant things that we can do in that regard, and that's part of what Illuminate is doing. Thank you.
Very, very illuminating. What I'm kind of thinking is, I've been married, not that you need to know this, it's probably too much data, but I've been married over 30 years, and I'm now beginning to wonder, has my wife been right that long? You know, should I have been listening to her more? And the answer is probably yes. Okay. With that, let me actually throw the first question out there. I know, Chuck, we've got to get off stage here. But you've had the benefit, I think, of listening to some of the other panelists and some of the program managers actually have been here during the course of the day. Given what you know about the community from a finance perspective and, your collective hands-on experience and the studies that you've done, what kind of recommendations might you have for the SBIR program in terms of how we can increase the participation of minorities and women?
I think from my standpoint, it's promoting it more. I have occasion to,
Okay. Yeah, I think from my standpoint in Philadelphia, it's all about promoting it more. All of the minority companies with which I have contact, both in the Ben Franklin portfolio and the Minority Angel Investor Network portfolio, know about SBIR simply because we tell them about SBIR. We love SBIR. Investors love it because it's non-dilutive capital. So when I have a chance to talk to minority-owned or led companies from outside the area, I also talk about SBIR. So I think it's one of the biggest problems with SBIR is recognition, just getting communication, getting the word out, what it is and how to get it.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is perhaps one of the biggest obstacles that women face, frankly, is fear of rejection. There's the issue of, if I don't see and I don't know of any other women who've taken this road of financing, whether that be venture or SBI or anything else, how do I know I can succeed? And so, you know, making sure that there are good examples and that there are people involved in the evaluation process that look and feel like the people that are applying for the funding helps. There's no question about it.
Chuck, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I did. I mean, this is an important topic, and there are two things I'd like to raise. One, what Terry was just saying about making sure that there's more knowledge about the SBR program is out there. This thing that Cindy, I very much like the presentation, but the one part I don't understand is create more women investors. How do we do that? Well, let me hear your answer first, but there's one quick follow-up if I...
Okay, well, there's two sides to that. There's on the angel side that clearly there will be more women angel investors. That the number of women angel investors has grown from 3% of all angel investors to about 15% in just the last 10 years. That's happening because all of those companies that are being formed and those women are having success, you know, will go into that. The bigger problem is in venture, where you have 10-year partnerships, where they are actually raising, as we heard earlier, smaller pools of capital than previously, which means they don't need to add any partners, and so it's not a malicious issue at all. I think it really has to be about forming organizations like we have with Illuminate that are smaller, more nimble operations that will do early stage investing in women-led companies. It's not going to happen from particularly from adding more to the large firms. They're not adding people.
Well, Cindy, I think that's interesting because if what you and others are doing can show returns, then that will attract, in principle, that attracts additional assets. Ty, could I just make a suggestion? Just to make sure they're wide awake, why don't we ask some of the program managers here what they think, what, if anything, they think can be done. Recognizing in principle the program is already gender and minority blind. I mean, it is an opportunity. But I'd be interested to know if they think that there's what pragmatically and practically could be done.
Sure, sure. And I think it's and you correct me if I'm wrong, but my memory tells me that in the first phase of the study of the five major agencies, the performance in that regard was a little over all over the board. Some were doing very well, and if you use some of the target numbers in terms of just, you know, 8A set asides and hub zones and things of that nature as a benchmark for what that level of participation should be relative to the SBIR program, I think it was mixed. So, are there, who's here from the agencies? Yeah, you want to just jump up here?
I hate not facing the audience, but. Yes, my name is Joe Mazzane, and I'm the deputy director in the Office of Small Business Programs up at OSD. We've met before, yeah, when Tony was there. This particular issue has come across a couple of times during the course of the year. There's no provision in the U.S. Code for us to do anything in terms of the set-aside, in terms of awards, in terms of preferences. However, it's firmly one of the four goals that Mr. Gansler showed this morning. I was hoping to get some ideas here in this forum on how we can do that, because when you don't have a legislative tool, and we can ask for one, that's an obvious solution, what we do is we default to better outreach, more outreach. So we target places to go to, communities to speak with. I spoke with David Hinson over in the Minority Business Development, the national director over there, and with the idea perhaps that we could form some sort of partnership so that, you know, he has a cadre of folks out there that kind of gets word out to that community. We have a similar group. Maybe we can do something together to get the word out to both communities about the program. But I will say that if we look at the participation rates on the SBIR program, they're pretty high, much higher than the DOD averages four awards to women-owned, service-disabled, or small disadvantaged businesses, and on the order of 10% or higher for this category. So we're doing a good job now, even though we don't have any tools to do it, but we could be doing better, I guess, with more outreach, and if we get a legislative tool thrown into the toolkit, that could help as well.
Another thing that has been very helpful for us in Pennsylvania is this innovation partnership program that John Sider talked about a little earlier, where we actually provide small grants to companies to pay consultants to help them write their proposals. Many of the companies that we talk to are just intimidated by the whole process of writing one of these monstrous documents. So having perhaps some way to defray some of the expense to bring someone in to help them write it could be of some value.
Let me just respond, if I may. Jill, you made a comment. If I'm not mistaken, the number of women that are successfully participating in DOD's program actually has been going up over the past several years, while those in the African community have been going down, actually. So this performance that you're talking about by women is true. The other thing is, I think it's great that you're reaching out to David Henson, who's head of MBDA. If you look at their client base, though, you will see that their portfolio is largely driven by or inclusive of service-oriented companies, and they themselves are struggling to be able to reach out and understand the tech community. And in fact, if they were really, and I'm trying to be respectful here, if they were perhaps as successful as I think they could be, they would be an integral part of, already have been an integral part of, when in fact there's a joint strike fighter about to be developed, then the DOD would be reaching it, working with them very closely to identify those very promising emerging high-tech companies coming out of the minority and women-owned community. So that's I've been working with them for a number of years, and that's kind of, you know, based on experience. So.
Hi, I'm Joanne Goodnight, the program manager for NIH's SBIR and SDTR programs. First, I just want to commend Chuck and Dr. Gensler for pulling together this session. I think, you know, it is and has always been one of the four major goals of the SBIR program. And in any of the studies that any of us have done, it seems to be one of these, well, how do we even assess this? How do we track it? So one thing when the Academy did the study with NIH is they actually pointed out a data error the way back in our paper days our information was being collected. So that kind of muddied the waters because companies were either just checking small business as opposed to small and women-owned or small and disadvantaged. Now that we're in the electronic world, all of that has been corrected, and that's a good thing. That still doesn't get at the current situation. And coming back to Joe, I mean, we're doing more with outreach. This year, it's part of our GIPRA plan, in fact, to do more targeted outreach to women-owned and small and disadvantaged companies. I just got back from Kentucky. There was a session called the Leaky Pipeline. We're actually, for our 12th annual NIH SBIR conference, holding a specific session. And I may tap some of you to bring in some of these very interesting comments and studies that you've done. So with all of that said, it's a self-certification program. And my sense is some of these companies don't even want to certify, that they would just rather check small, even though we know that they're, you know, a category within small. And the other thing I think we want to start looking at are the principal investigators, because there's ownership of the small business, but then who's really the principal investigator or in the team of these projects? So whatever it's worth, those are my comments.
One feedback point that I get from many women who are growing their businesses, and the issue they face is, do I take venture capital or do I get some of the preferences I might have as a woman-owned business? Because it really is either or. And that's a very tough position to be in. If you are a venture-backed company, more than likely, you've given 15 to 20% of your business to your employees, and you've given another 30% or more of your business to your investors. Therefore, you are not a majority owner of that business. And that's a real obstacle for many women-owned businesses.
Right, and just to follow on that, in the SBIR program, there is no preferential treatment, but for a lot of small businesses, SBIR should be and is one piece of their whole business development plan. So they may be, you know, in this conundrum of what am I giving up versus some other preferences.
Joanne is always hard to follow on a program. I'm Joe Hennessy from the National Science Foundation, senior advisor, and I'm glad to see Tyrone here because he and I have wrestled with this question for a long time. He was a member of our advisory committee. But I also want to thank Chuck and the rest of his team for putting this program together because I think it's been very enlightening. This whole area of women and minorities in the small business program is something that, you know, it was highlighted in the reports as something we've struggled with over the years. One of the problems we have at NSF is the reporting mechanism, and it's probably similar to what Joanne just mentioned. Any information about being women-owned or minority-owned is strictly voluntary, and we find that many people don't bother to check that box. Of the ones that do, the success rate for the for folks in that category that submit proposals, at least to NSF, is comparable to everybody else. So there doesn't seem to be any differentiation. We have experimented, and we were disappointed, with a program to give supplements to successful small businesses who had been all the way through the phase two process to get them to mentor in their local areas another small business that might be aspiring to join the SBIR program. And we were really surprised about the lack of interest in that particular program. We thought for sure we'd have people. I don't remember the amount of money. It was in the $20,000-$25,000, and Tyrone may remember it. But we were really disappointed. In fact, we took it off of our website. We're going to go back and revisit that. But the thing that that I guess concerns me is that every time we go to one of these national meetings, which is an opportunity for any small business to have a chance to talk to all 11 agencies, how few individuals from that represent both women-owned and minority-owned companies we see at those meetings. You look around. The last one we had was in Nevada, in Reno, last fall, and you looked around that group, and there were very few folks there. And you realize this when you do a lot of one-on-one meetings, which I do. I don't talk to many people that fall in that category. And I'll be willing to bet next week we have another big meeting in Connecticut. And I think we'll probably see the same phenomena. You know, you look across the audience when you're standing up there giving a presentation, and it's primarily white male. And I don't know. I mean, and there's a lot of effort been made to try to reach out to encourage people to participate. But I wish we could find a way to get more people to at least come and talk to us about the funding opportunities that are available to support their business. But right at that, and that's probably the most effective place to talk to all 11 agencies in a cost-effective fashion about your interests. So if there's anybody who has any great ideas about how we can do a better job of promoting those kinds of programs and getting people to come and at least get the information. The other thing I've seen is I think there needs to be more effort put in at the state level on some of these so-called phase zero programs, because a lot of these folks have a great deal of difficulty in preparing a competitive proposal. They get intimidated by the process. And the process is somewhat intimidating because it depends on what agency you're talking to. Every one of us has our nuances in what the proposal requirements are. So I think the opportunity is out there, but I don't think we've found the right, the right mechanisms to, you know, I'd like to see the submission rate go up by at least 10 or 15%.
Back to the issue about attendance at the conferences. Again, I think it's all about targeted communication. Send information to me. I will get it out to the tech companies that I know, and I know a lot of minority-owned technology companies up and down the East Coast. I think it's going to take a targeted communication effort.
I'm going to be even more explicit and maybe a little controversial here. When other organizations have had the same issue, why aren't we seeing more women? Why aren't we seeing more Hispanics? Why aren't we seeing more blacks? Why aren't we, et cetera? the outreach has to come from within their own communities. And so you have got to have the support of women reaching out to women, of black men reaching out to black men, whatever the target audience is, because I will tell you, even at Carnegie Mellon, when we were disappointed with the number of women coming, accepting the offer to come and join the the programs there, what made the difference was having other women call them themselves and say, I did it, you can succeed here, you know, it's a great place to go to school.
Let me be even more controversial. I think it takes minorities within minorities, and I say that this to mean you can't speak of minorities as this homogeneous group.
No.
Latinos respond to Latinos, African Americans to African Americans, and so on. I have companies in my portfolio that cover a breadth of minorities, and they're more responsive when a Latino is talking to a Latino, an Asian to an Asian. So it has to be targeted,
right.
Kind of targeted in that way.
Controversial, but it struck me as odd. I was at Morgan State University. Actually, Morgan State University is hosting the Minority Serving Research Institution program this week, and it is a culmination of all of the leading HBCU and MIs. And within that group are 16, 17, 18 accredited, you know, engineering schools and all of that. Nowhere on the agenda, as best I could tell, nowhere. Was there anything related to the SBIR program? Mm-hmm. Now, there was a program manager or a PEO here and there scattered throughout the program, but there was not that dialogue taking place, which included a little bit of the community that we all represent here. So I think it's sometimes it's more about going to where they are as opposed to you going to where you typically gather. Okay?
Yeah, that's disappointing because, as you know, we have a special supplements program. For those universities, if you have a Phase Two award with us, you can get a supplement up to an additional $100,000 for carrying out a complementary research program with groups like that, and those we get quite a few proposals in that area. It's you know, probably we make 15 awards a year at least to that group, but that's disappointing because we're probably not touching we're not going to the right meetings.
You were so patient.
Yes,
to get
I
out
was.
Of the way. Yes.
Even though Chuck cut me off at the pass.
Right. Well, you got to watch out. For Chuck.
I know that. You always got to worry about Chuck. I want to talk about some positive things for the future. I'm at the University of Rochester, and I teach a course called Technical Entrepreneurship. It's a graduate class with half MBAs and half engineering students. They form business units of two MBAs and two engineers. This year, the number of women in the class is almost equal to the number of men. And we don't do any special recruiting. I mean, the point of the matter is, I mean, this is the way it's coming out. We're now 15% African American. So I think things are starting to evolve. I think the whole issue of entrepreneurship is a field of study. I mean, it's been, at Rochester, we're very strongly in finance. I mean, that's what we're known for in our business school. And what we're seeing is more and more students are choosing entrepreneurship, and with just the self-selection process is being, I think, is really going to go forward, and I think these problems, it's going to work themselves out. Having said that, it's going to take another decade. I mean, that's just the reality.
Yeah, I think it'll take time, but I think it's important here. These are challenges, and amongst those challenges, I think, again, using the SBIR program as the example, there's enormous opportunity. And I think the opportunity kind of, in many ways, outweighs the challenges. Okay. And if we're focused, and I think this is, if ever there's a group of folks that are committed to seeing something done, it is, you know, as we've learned over the last couple of years, it is the SBIR community. And so I am quite frankly excited about the opportunity. I am quite frankly excited about the richness in our, as a nation, in terms of our S&T base. And if Joe continues to work with MBDA and others, and we continue to, NSF continues to do some novel things, and Joanne continues to do some things, then my sense is that we're going to get there. You know, it may not happen overnight, but my sense is we're going to get there. So I want to make sure that we're not conveying kind of a complaining, you know, griping, but we are committed to the cause. And we'll say that. Okay? Yes.
Hi. Thanks very much for, first of all, including this topic in the conference today. My name is Shelley Porges, and I'm a senior advisor at the Department of State, leading an initiative called the Global Women's Business Initiative, focused on global women's entrepreneurship. So this this topic is very near and dear to our hearts. One of the trends or elements that we see, we certainly know it in the U.S. and we're starting to see it in other countries, is a concept called the missing middle. And that is, in the U.S., of the approximately 10 plus million women-owned businesses, only 2.4% ever get to even $1 million in revenue. We're not even talking profits, we're just talking revenues. About another 1.8 million are in this area called the missing middle, between $250,000 and $750,000 in revenue. And we find that they get stuck. Now, most recently, before joining the State Department 2 weeks ago, I chaired an organization called Count Me In for Women's Economic Independence. And what we did through that program, you could call it a sort of virtual incubator, we were able to accelerate the growth of these businesses, and over 30% of the businesses that we targeted got to the $1 million-plus mark. Our top woman, who had gotten stuck at $350,000 for 6 years, last 2 years ago did $5.1 million. Last year, $14.1 million. She now she did hire 10 people in the beginning. Now she's got 135 people. This is obviously the kind of growth we want to see, the kind of companies that we want to support. What can we do? What are some of the key strategies, since we're talking about the positive side of this, which is not what haven't we done to date, but really what can we do going forward? What do you see, what have you seen as the most effective strategies for both reaching the high potential, high impact businesses that are out there? So what we know is that certainly there's a vast majority who will never make it or who will stay small, perhaps want to stay small. But there is certainly another contingent, about in the women's market, it's about 15 to 18% in the U.S., some of whom, at least, have that potential, but never break out enough to even get to considering equity capital, or outside equity capital, I should say.
Well, I've seen several things be very effective. At Carnegie Mellon, for example, there's a program that's not exclusively about women. It's for women and men, that is an incubator environment for high-tech companies. In the Bay Area, which is where I'm from, the San Francisco Bay Area, there are a number of nonprofit programs that are very focused on the key word that you talked about was getting people mentoring and advising them, and that was really key to the acceleration, pretty dramatic acceleration of businesses in the Bay Area. There's a group called Astia that focuses on life sciences, biotech, clean tech, et cetera, kinds of companies at the very earliest stages, and helps them by assigning mentors that have the right kind of skills and experience. They're all volunteers. There's not a cost, you know, to doing that. There's another group called the Women's Initiative for Self-Employment that does similar things. But it really is about, it's not just about capital. It really is also about educating these people on how to think bigger, on how to take additional risk and grow their businesses. But it's hard to identify them.
I think that's really vitally important. There are a number of incubation programs that we have in the Philadelphia area. One comes to mind, in which we're an investor, called Dream It Ventures. And it's all about bringing very young IT-focused 20-somethings in town for an 11-week intensive process. We give each team about $20,000, $25,000, we call it beer and pizza money, and have them come in and work on a product that hopefully will be productized and turn into a company by the end of the 11 weeks. During that 11 weeks, we surround them with all kinds of mentors, accountants, investors, you name it. At the end of the 11 weeks, they get to pitch to venture investors and angel investors. And many of them actually secure dollars, actually secure funding after being together for an intensive program of 11 weeks. I think those programs work.
I want to just add one other thing that hits me, because I apologize. A really good example of out there of people who've made this work are Indian entrepreneurs here in the U.S. And they are people who 30 years ago were treated as second-class citizens. They were just labor. Come in, and you've got engineering skills. We need you to do that. They're now the most sought-after entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley to found companies, to be CEOs of companies. In fact, if you don't have an Indian VP of engineering, people probably think there's something wrong with your company. So I spent time asking those people how they made it happen, and there's a long story, but the short version is they consolidated. They don't have 50 Indian entrepreneurship organizations. They have one. It's called TAI, the Indus Entrepreneurs. It is worldwide. It has 70 chapters around the world. And if you've ever been to one of their events, they blow you away because every single person there who's on the podium is about helping every single person in the audience. They're not there for self-glory or aggrandizement. It's a really impressive program. But it made me think, when we talk about all these fragmented programs, that's part of the problem.
Listen, let me. I'm going to have to stop at this point, but I do want to thank everyone for their participation. But if you'd also help me thank the panelists, they've done a great job.